This is December the 31st, 1992. I am Captain Philip S. Neal, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, retired. The slides you're about to see were taken by me during my tour of duty with the Northwest Service Command from August of 1942 to May of 1945. My first assignment was with the 341st Engineer General Service Regiment as a platoon commander on the initial construction of the Pioneer Road on the Alcan Highway. When my regiment was reassigned back to the States in July of 1943, I was reassigned to the U.S. Engineering Department on administration of the civilian contractors building the permanent all-weather road. This included assignments in Fort St. John, Fort Nelson, and Dawson Creek, British Columbia. My final assignment was as Assistant Service Command Ordnance Officer at the Northwest Service Command Headquarters in Whitehorse, Yukon Territory. Fortunately, these assignments provided me with the opportunity to take these slides, covering both the Alcan Highway and the Canal Oil Project. Our tour starts in Edmonton, Alberta, through which passed all the men and materials used on the Alcan Highway as far north as Watson Lake, as well as the Canal Project. Our military bases in Alaska could only be supplied by sea or air. After Pearl Harbor, when the Japs moved into the Aleutians, it became readily apparent the necessity for an overland route to Alaska. The major obstacles were the 1,600 miles of wilderness, rivers, and mountains that had to be traversed. In March of 1942, agreement was reached with the Canadian government to build the highway. We were given free access and permission to use native materials. There were no supplies or native labor available. It all had to be shipped up from the States. 7 engineer regiments, totaling approximately 11,000 men, were assigned the task of building the Pioneer Road from the end of Steele and Dawson Creek, British Columbia, 1,600 miles through the wilderness, up and across the Continental Divide into Fairbanks, Alaska. Civilian contractors then came in and built the all-weather road. The route was chosen to be able to service a string of small Canadian air bases stretching from Edmonton, Alberta to Fairbanks, Alaska. There were only 4 points of entry into that vast wilderness: railroads into Dawson Creek, British Columbia, Whitehorse, Yukon Territory, and Fairbanks, Alaska, plus a road in from Valdez, Alaska. My outfit was the 341st Engineer General Service Regiment. They arrived in Dawson Creek the end of April of 1942. I did not get assigned there until August. Their first mission was to build the Pioneer Road to Fort Nelson, 265 miles north from Fort St. John, through basically uninhabited wilderness. Work started with aerial surveys, then survey parties on horseback to flag the route, followed by troops with heavy Caterpillar earth-moving equipment. Actually, my regiment, working 20 hours a day in the long summer daylight hours, opened the road into Fort Nelson in the incredibly short time of 56 days. Major problems were swamp-like areas called muskeg, river and stream crossings, and mosquitoes, not necessarily in that order. Now let's get on with the show. This overall map shows you some idea of the vast territory up there in Canada. The darker brown on the left side is the higher elevations of the mountains, the Rockies and so forth, and that's where the highway was built. This is Edmonton, Alberta, and that's the Hudson Bay Trading Company big department store there. And take note of the paved streets, because this is the last time we'll see them till we get all the way up to Fairbanks. Capitol Building in Edmonton, Alberta. This shows a railroad route from Edmonton up through Grand Prairie into Dawson Creek, a distance of about 450 miles, and it took 4 days for the train to make the trip. This is, gives you an idea of the type of terrain we passed through, prairie land mostly, with wheat as a major product. This was one of the major trestle bridges on the Northern Alberta Railroad leading into Dawson Creek. And this is Dawson Creek itself back in 1942. That mud was deep and sticky to the boots. Dawson Creek was founded in 1912. By 1942, the population was still less than 1,000 people. And this is the famous milepost zero in Dawson Creek. This picture was taken 10 years later in 1952. And you see things had dried out at least a little. This is a typical house in Dawson Creek. They had no lawns, front lawns, because they had no water system. But some of the houses did have nice flower gardens in their front yard. Since there was no water system available in Dawson Creek, they'd bring the drinking water around a couple times a week in a wooden tank wagon. And if you wanted to take your Saturday night bath, you had to go to one of these steam and shower bath places. And this is the first large bridge on the Alcan Highway across the Kiskatinaw River. Engineers designed this 190-foot wooden bridge with a banked 9-degree curve to conform with the bend in the highway. Constructed by a Canadian company, this engineering marvel took 9 months to complete. It was the first curved wooden bridge built in Canada. And today, 50 years later, few like it remain. The Alaskan Highway has been rerouted and straightened, so it no longer passes over this bridge, but the bridge itself is still in use. This log cabin dwelling gives you an idea of the native habitat located between Dawson Creek and Fort St. John, but there are very few inhabitants up in that area. This was a major bridge on the Alcan Highway across the Peace River. It looks peaceful, but it was not really. Had a very strong current, and after a number of years, it washed out some of the footing under the far pier, the far tower, so badly that it turned a little bit. And when it did, it pulled out this massive abutment from the far end, and when that happened, the whole bridge collapsed. It has since been replaced with a more modern structure. This is Fort St. John, the next town above Dawson Creek. This is the oldest town in the area. It was founded in 1793 as a fur trading post. By 1942, it had a population of less than 1,500. Notice the winter supply of wood stacked against the side of the general store. This is my friend Herman and I. He was one of the natives. And we used to go out in the morning before he'd go on to work, shoot some prairie chickens we could have for dinner that night. We're now going north from Fort St. John, 265 miles to Fort Nelson on the east side of the Rockies. This is up along Charlie Lake, and this was the farthest north point that the civilian contractors could bring their families. This is the daughter of one of the contractor's employees with her baby coyote. Here we can see the construction of the all-weather road. It had about a 9-inch gravel surface on the top. You notice in the fall colors is all the gold of the aspen. No red up there, no hardwoods. Here we see the contrast between the pioneer road in the background, which had to follow the contour of the land, and the contractors working in the foreground, straightening out the highway. Yes, that is a Greyhound bus down there. It was bringing out part of my regiment in this July of 1943. Here we see how the road was located on the lower end up along the tops of the hills, so so it had good drainage. The field of fireweed got its name from the fact that it would bloom after the forest fire had burned through an area. Now we're at a lower elevation approaching Fort Nelson. We're out of the evergreens and into the white poplar trees. The big town of Fort Nelson across the Musqua River. The way to get there was by boat in the summertime or across the ice in the wintertime. That building in the upper right there with the black roof was the Hudson Bay Trading Post. And this is up there by the trading post. All those Indian kids had to have their own dog teams. And that lady standing on the left was my secretary when I was stationed in Fort Nelson. The relay station in Fort Nelson, the trucks would be loaded in Dawson Creek and driven all the way through to Fairbanks, stopping every 50 miles at relay stations to change drivers. The Fort Nelson relay station was one of the major repair setups. It was about 300 miles from Dawson Creek. And you didn't have to get up early to see the sunrise in Fort Nelson. This picture was taken about 9:30 in the morning. The road now swings west, going through the Rockies, up past Watson Lake and into Whitehorse. This is Contact Creek, which was appropriately named because it was the point where the troops working from the north and from the south met to really open the highway all the way from Dawson Creek into Fairbanks in November of 1942. This is one of the types of engineer bridges built from native timber, and that mountain in the background, the Indians called Steamboat Mountain, probably because they had never seen a steamboat. Another view of Steamboat Mountain, and you can see in the wintertime the highway was just like a concrete highway, and it was because of the cold weather, the snow was just like sand, so you could really travel. Along the highway, a few places we saw these trappers cabins or huts. They would come in the fall, either walk in or be flown in, spend the winter trapping, and then either take their furs out by on foot in the spring or have somebody come in and pick them up. Later on we'll see a much better cabin. This is up along the Tesla River. That extra pile of stone out there was to divert the force of the ice during the spring breakup. The first year it wasn't there, and as a result this whole section of road in which I was standing to take this picture was washed out. We're up now along approaching Summit Lake. That's Stone Mountain there in the background, an elevation about 9,000 feet, and you can see it's well above the timberline. This is Summit Lake itself, one of the pretty lakes along the road. This was at an elevation of 4,215 feet, which was the highest elevation on the Alcan Highway. This was a massive rock cut that the contractors were able to do with their time and equipment. The poor troops had to put the road in down the bottom of the canyon. This is McDonald Canyon, a pretty spot off to the south of the highway, but there were no hamburger stands up there at that time. These were stone pillars were left over from when the glaciers receded. The Indians thought they looked like, called them voodoo pillars. This was a type of culvert that the contractors could put in. They were treated timber culverts. This particular stream never froze over in the wintertime because there were some hot springs located in the area. I noticed the snow-capped mountain in the background, even though this picture was taken in the middle of May. This is a little more snow. This was called an alluvial fan, where the stones slid down off the mountain into the valley. And this is the one that didn't get away. I always carried my rifle with me when I was on the road. Came up over a little hill this day, and there was this wolf standing in the middle of the highway. So I stopped the car and got out, and he ran over into this light underbrush. So I let him have it with my .30-06. He just dropped on the spot. He made a nice rug. We were camped along this pretty little lake in the fall of 42 while we were putting in culverts up in the area. This is another type of engineer bridge called a bent bridge. And each one of those individual vents were fabricated and then dropped into place and then the deck put on top of them. This was a crossing of the Swift River. This is what happened in the spring of 43 when the road didn't have proper drainage, and this is the mud got pretty deep. This was a type of native timber culvert that we put in. That timber was cut right in that local area there, and the culvert constructed and the road pushed back over top of it. When we were putting in all those culverts, I could take my platoon out, turn them over to the sergeant, and then I could take a hike up the side of the mountain to look over the general area. And this is what that country was like up there. Just trees and more trees. The only sign of civilization was where the road went over the tops of those little hills in the background. I figured that's about 20 miles down there. And here we were doing some blasting under the bridge at the lower crossing of the Rancheria River. And that's the highway back there, and we had to be careful not to blow up the bridge. But we had to get the ice out so it wouldn't take the bridge out. So we were putting in a higher level pile-driven bridge, which you can see behind the original bridge. This was a pile-driven bridge. These piling were 20, 30 feet long. They were cut right in that general area, floated down the river, hoisted into place with the pile driver. This picture was taken about 10:30 at night. The troops were working from like 4 o'clock in the morning to 10:30 at night to get this bridge in, because they'd been told once this bridge was in, they could go home. And this was a completed bridge, which made a pretty picture. And this is a geological fault seen up along the highway. It was called Folded Mountain. And here we see what was left of the Pioneer Bridge in the foreground, the bench there, and the background is the bridge that the contractors put in over the Trout River. Pretty little waterfall I found along the highway. And this is up along the Toad River, characterized by that pretty blue color. And this gives you an idea of the problem going through the mountains. We had to find the places where there was enough room between the mountainside and the river to put in the highway. Pretty bluebells I saw up along the road. And this is up at Muncho Lake. There's a baby moose there in the foreground, and another one lying down in the background. When the troops went through, the animals up there were not frightened of human beings because they had never seen that many of them. So the GIs would go out in the woods and they'd pet these baby moose, and then the mothers wouldn't have anything to do with them. So they'd have to bring them into camp and feed them. And so they built this corral not to keep the moose in, but to keep the grizzly bears out, because baby moose was a delicacy for the big old grizzly bears. Here we can see the Pioneer Road in the foreground, and the contractors' road they built down along the lake, where they had the time and equipment to do the blasting so they could get the road down along the lake. This is Muncho Lake, and the highway follows along it for about 7 miles. I think this is one of the prettiest lakes on the whole route. This is up along the Trout River. A picture was taken about 20 degrees below zero, and the steam was still coming off the river. Trapper's cabin up along one of the little lakes, and this guy really had it made. He came in the fall by plane, landed on the lake, and spent the winter in this nice cabin, and then he'd be flown out in the spring with his winter catch of birds. This was a shot on the inside of the cabin. Those two light-colored furs are lynx, and the trapper said they're the most difficult to trap because they're really a hunting animal. Now, the one on the right is a Wolverine. The one hanging over the table on the left is a Stone Marten, and there are a few Red Fox furs hanging on the wall. This is the bridge across the lower crossing of the Liard River, which was the other major river up in that area of Canada. And this picture is a little bit of an optical illusion. This is down by the hot springs near the Liard River. I took this picture to get the purple flowers up on top of this sulfur deposit, but it's a little bit confusing because it's only about 12 inches down to the water. The contractors had built a couple of bathhouses up there over the hot springs, because that was quite a popular place. In fact, it had been popular with the Indians before the white men ever got there. And this is what it looked like in the wintertime, and it was still in use because the water temperature remained around 113 degrees. This was the real spring breakup of 1943, whereas they literally said the road went out because of lack of drainage. This is a close-up of the same area where they were putting in the corduroy road. When we were lucky, we could get some sawed timber if we were near a sawmill. Otherwise, they cut trees down right along the edge of the road and laid this corduroy, and then they'd shove it up dirt over it with a bulldozer, and it sometimes got to 9 or 10 layers of this corduroy before it got down to a firm foundation that would support the truck traffic. This is the upper crossing of the Liard River, and the piling on the left side of the picture was what's left of the old engineer bridge. I was driving up the road one day, and this when the contractors were moving their heavy equipment in the spring of 43, and this fellow was stopped over on this side of the bridge, and I asked him what the problem was, and he said, "Well, will that bridge hold me?" I said, "Sure it will." So I got my camera ready just in case it didn't, but it did. So while we were up there and we had time, we were adding another lane to that bridge, and seated up there on the abutment was the supervisory committee. That officer on the left was our battalion dentist, so he always had to handle all the bridge work. And here again we see what happened when they didn't have the right proper drainage. That vehicle on the right was my weapons carrier that could get me around in that kind of weather, rough road. Here we were putting in one of the native timber culverts. It was built right in place, and then they used a bulldozer to shove the road back up over top of it. And when we were lucky, we were near a sawmill, we could build it a culverts out of sawed timber. And you can see how they pushed the dirt up there on the right, put the culvert in place, and then pushed the dirt road back over top of it. In the spring, the fishing was pretty good. Those were northern pike. That officer on the left was with my company. The one in the center was a Signal Corps officer, and the one on the right was a civilian contractor attached to the Signal Corps, which put in the telephone line all the way from Dawson Creek to Fairbanks. And here the contractors are cutting down this side of the hill to level out the highway. Now we're up at Lower Post. This was the next village above Fort Nelson along the Liard River. And that building up there with the black stripe across, that's the Hudson Bay Trading Post. This is a close-up of that same building. You notice the sign says Hudson Bay Company Incorporated, May of 1670. Here are some more of the natives. That little kid there in the middle of the street came running around the end of the house there, and when he saw me taking this picture, typical of a kid, he stuck his tongue out at me. This is the longest bridge on the highway across the mouth of the Sutton Bay, and in the background is the little town of Teslin.
This is Johnson's Crossing. This is where the road takes off for Norman Wells and the Canal Oil Project.
The other major project, essential to the success of the Alcan Highway, was to develop an adequate fuel supply in that isolated section of North America. And this was the Canadian Oil or Canal Project. The magnitude of this project, to develop an oil field, lay 600 miles of pipeline from Norman Wells to Whitehorse, build a refinery in Whitehorse, and lay 900 miles of pipeline up and down the Alcan Highway, required a consortium of three major contractors, Bechtel, Price, and Callahan. It was started in June of 1942, 2,500 engineer troops plus the civilian contractors' employees. Supplies had to be moved by rail from Edmonton, Alberta, to the end of steel at waterways in Northwest Territory, then 1,100 miles by water to Norman Wells on the Mackenzie River. A small oil field had been discovered back in 1920. The only means of transportation were boats in the summer and dog sleds in the winter. At waterways, barges were built for water transportation 450 miles down the Slave River to Great Slave Lake, which is the fifth largest lake in the North American continent. Then 150 miles across the lake, and finally 500 miles down the Mackenzie River to Norman Wells. On the North American continent, the Mackenzie River is second only to the Mississippi in length and drainage area. The freeze-up came in October, and that stopped the river traffic, so the troops had to build a 1,000-mile-long winter road down the Mackenzie River to keep the supplies moving until spring. Before the project was finished, 60 to 70,000 tons of supplies had been moved over that 1,100-mile water route to Norman Wells. Reconnaissance flights to locate the 600-mile route from Norman Wells to Whitehorse began in June of 1942. Few men had ever crossed the Continental Divide from the Yukon to the Mackenzie River. Construction was started from both ends, but the entire 600-mile canal road was passable in 20 months. The pipeline was being welded at 40 to 50 degrees below zero and laid directly on the ground. The quality of the oil was so good that it would continue to flow at minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit and could be used directly in the diesel trucks as well as in the diesel engines at the 10 pumping stations. In respect to the area covered, the time of accomplishment, and sheer pioneering, the pipeline and refinery project, combined with the Alcan Highway, was destined to become the biggest construction project in the history of the world. You will notice a difference in the type of terrain along the Canal Road from that found along the Alcan Highway. Imagine the first bulldozer operator that made this cut on this mountainside when it's a sheer drop of about 1,000 feet down to that riverbed. This is one of the pipeline crossings over the Pelly River coming in from Norman Wells. They wanted to be sure that the pipeline was safe, so across the larger rivers they built bridges. The truck traffic would either ford these streams or some few places they built bridges. This is the only civilization existing between Johnson's Crossing and Norman Wells, with this small village of Ross Post. You can see the canal road coming down in the background off the side of that mountain. This was another river crossing across the Lappy River. This is a little hard to distinguish, but that's my poor little Jeep down there on the right. I was coming down this long hill, icy, and I lost control. There was a curve at the bottom, so I rolled down this bank, rolled over a couple times, and ended up against that tree. And it was
starting to get dark, and so I decided I better build a fire if I could. So I laid the fire up there on the highway, and unfortunately I didn't have any matches with me, but I did have my trusty Boy Scout knife. So I sparked across the battery, got a piece of paper going, took it up and got my fire going. But it was starting to get dark, and the wolves were starting to howl, and I was sure hoping somebody was going to come along and pick me up. And sure enough, after a while somebody did. So I went back the next morning to pull my Jeep out of the snowbank, and lo and behold, this big tank truck had done the same thing I did. Of course, he didn't roll over, but he slid down the bank and crushed my poor little Jeep. And that was the end of the Jeep.
This was a sunrise on the Kanawha Road. You didn't have to get up very early to see this one either.
This is out across McMillan Pass, the high point on the Kanawha Road, up around 5,000 feet. Very desolate country. This is one of the 10 pumping stations along the Kanawha Road, used to boost up the pressure so they could keep the oil flowing all the way into Whitehorse. Here we're going across the Plains of Abraham. Another high spot on this road where the wind was usually blowing, and so it was always a good idea if you could follow a bulldozer across this area so you didn't get stuck in the drifting snow. This was a little narrow slit in the mountains called Echo Canyon. Going over closer to Norman Wells, and this area was called Dodo Canyon. I guess this is where the dodo birds spend their winter. Now we're looking out across the Mackenzie River. That long black streak down the center of the river there was one of the islands, but it was low in the water, so they had to get all the equipment off before the ice went out in the spring. On down to the right is Goose Island, and that was high above the water so they could continue drilling out there in the wintertime. And that's one of the drill rigs out on Goose Island. First winter they didn't think they could do it, drill all winter, but the second winter they just kept on drilling, despite the low temperatures. And this is what it looked like down in the drill house. These guys are working away at 20 degrees below zero. This is an oil flare. They had to burn off the wax to keep the lines open, and it made quite a spectacular sight at night. These were called Wanigans, and this is what this house on bobsleds was what they lived and worked on when they were laying the pipeline. This is Norman Wells across the Mackenzie River. This oil field was discovered back in 1920. And this refinery was still in operation, and it was big enough at that time to supply all the needs of lubrication and even aviation fuel that was used along the Mackenzie River. Of course, it wasn't big enough to supply the oil needs for the Kanawha project. They drilled about 30 wells in this area and got up to a capacity of about 3,000 barrels a day. This shot was taken from out in the middle of Mackenzie River about 1:30 in the afternoon, and the sun was pretty well down at that point. Now we'll get back to Johnson's Crossing and on up into Whitehorse. Blues River as we approach Whitehorse. And this is the entrance to Miles Canyon. Gold seekers in their mad haste to get to the Klondike would shoot their boats through here. Some of them made it. Most of them took the safer route by hauling their boats around. Another shot of Miles Canyon. It was one of the picturesque spots around Whitehorse. During the winter, if a thaw came along, the ice would break up and get shoved up on the bank, and so this made pretty good size ice cubes.
And this is the exit end of Miles Canyon. There was a dam constructed in the Luz River because back in the gold rush days when they were using those paddle wheel boats to move supplies from Whitehorse up into the Klondike, when they come back in the fall when the river water was down, they would get hung up on the shoals so they couldn't get back into Whitehorse. So they'd open the floodgates in this dam and then they would have to catch that wave of water to get up over the shoals and back into Whitehorse. This shot was taken from a little plateau up over the town of Whitehorse, down at the base of this hill along the river there are the railroad tracks for the White Pass and Yukon Railroad, which came up from Skagway. And there are a couple of those flat bottom paddle boats, and the building on the right says Whitehorse Steam Laundry, another relic of the gold rush days, which was still there in 1942. This is a shot also taken from up at on that plateau of the Whitehorse Air Base, and that's the Northwest Service Command buildings there in the foreground. During the peak of construction, the population of Whitehorse was well over 10,000 people, with the Service Command headquarters there, as well as the civilian contractors who were working on the canal project. We did find this little ski bowl out just outside of Whitehorse so we could get out of there over the weekends and enjoy a little recreation. That's the Whitehorse refinery. It was dismantled from some unused refineries back in the States and shipped up there and assembled in time to be ready for operation when the pipeline started to deliver oil from the canal project. This is an Indian cemetery in the vicinity of Whitehorse. They had some different ideas about covering their graves all the way from what looked like a canvas tent to this rather elaborate house. On the weekends they would have dog sled races on the Luz River. This happened to be one of the girl contestants. When I get home I would be asked about how things were in Alaska, and I'd have to tell the people I didn't know. I had never been up there. Never got over this section of the road, so a friend of mine and I hitchhiked by air one weekend from Whitehorse up to Fairbanks. And this is what we saw. On the one street there were all these log cabins, and that building in the background is a federal building, and in front of that there was a paved street. That's the locomotive, the original locomotive from the Alaskan Railroad that comes up from Anchorage down on the coast. And that's the original station in the background. This is out on the campus of the University of Alaska, and directly in the center of that picture, it said on a clear day you could see Mount McKinley. Of course it wasn't clear that day. And I was up there in August, and I couldn't see it then because it was cloud covered. Now we're back to Whitehorse, and we take the White Pass and Yukon Railroad down to the Skagway on the coast. And from there we take the inside passage down to Vancouver, British Columbia. This is the upper end of Lake Bennett. And that's the narrow gauge railroad running up from Skagway. The railroad follows down along the edge of the lake for about 27 miles. Here we are on the lower end of Lake Bennett, and that's the train that I came out on. And back in by May of 45, the construction was pretty well completed up there, so they were moving a lot of contractors' equipment out at that time. And that's the famous chapel on the lower end of Lake Bennett, which was started during the gold rush days of 98, but the gold rush was over before they ever completed it. But in this area here at the lower end is where they built their boats to
go the rest of the way by water, and they said there were as many as 10,000 people right in this area at that point. They were coming down the White Pass and Yukon Railroad down to Skagway. The railroad you can see hanging on the side of the mountain up the upper left side of the picture. And this area was called Dead Horse Gulch because the gold seekers in their mad haste to get to the Klondike, they loaded their equipment up on the horses, but they didn't take any food for them. So they just drove them till they dropped, and then they hand carried their rest of their equipment from there on up to Lake Bennett. Still going down through White Pass, you can see the railroad hanging to the edge of the mountain there at the bottom of the picture. This was a major bridge on the White Pass and Yukon Railroad. Looking back, you see the same bridge, and you also see Dead Horse Gulch over on the left. And this is the city of Skagway. Had a population of around 10,000 people at the peak of the gold rush, and also about the same when they at the peak of construction on the Alcan Highway and the Canal Project. This is looking across the Lynn Canal. On the left is Fort Chilkoot, which was original army post in Alaska right after we bought it from the Russians. And over on the right is the town of Haines, Alaska. On down the canal, that's a, you can see another glacier coming down to the water. This is the city of Juneau, Alaska, the capital of the state of Alaska, hanging on there at the foot of the mountain. Here we are coming down through the Wrangell Narrows, which has a very narrow channel marked with many buoys that the boat has to weave back and forth to stay in the channel. Very picturesque trip. Coming into Ketchikan, Alaska. At that time we were still at war with Japan, so we had a gun mounted on the back of the ship. And I had been very careful not to take a picture of it, but when I was up there, the deck officer came up and he said, "You can't take any pictures up here." And I said, "Okay." So after he left, I took a picture and had the gun in. This is Prince Rupert. It's the most northern port on the west coast that has railroad connections. So it was used as a subport of embarkation for Seattle. Since we were still at war with Japan, we had to wait till that launch came out and opened up the submarine net so we could get into dock. This is Victoria, British Columbia, the southern end of Vancouver Island. It is the capital of the province of British Columbia, and those are the parliament buildings in the background. And this is the Empress Hotel there in Victoria, a very elegant place to stay. And now we can see the ladies with their hats on, and we know we're back at civilization again. Here we are coming into the port of Vancouver, British Columbia. Now one last look at the map so you can tell where you have been in your travels. I hope you have found this tour both interesting and educational. Thank you.